You're listening to another episode of Open Source CXO, the podcast designed to share insights on how to excel in your business using technology, regardless of the industry. Host Robert Kehoe is a self-taught software developer who has grown to the role of CEO. Renowned for his collaborations with organizations such as Stanford University, Nelnet, and Louis Vuitton, he continually seeks new challenges to conquer in the world of tech. Accompanying him is Don Blackburn, a veteran COO with over 25 years of experience in cultivating diverse relationships and driving innovation in various technical projects. Each week, they'll be sitting down with some of the nation's foremost technology leaders to develop an open source playbook, drawing from their firsthand experiences in the field. Let's talk some tech.
Well, getting started today, for this episode, I wanted to point out that Robert is on vacation now that we're in the summer months, and filling in for Robert is David Welch. Dave is one of our directors at ActiveLogic and all-around good guy and podcast veteran himself. YouTube. Correct? YouTube, yeah. Not podcast?
I don't talk to other people. I just talk to myself.
Just talk to the camera. Yeah. I got you. All right.
He imagines the people.
Yeah, exactly.
And then our guest today is Alex Savinok, who is CTO of Rig, who's a startup SaaS product.
Yeah, SaaS product marketplace play, similar to Uber, focused on breakdowns in the trucking space.
Outstanding. And welcome, by the way, to our podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Interesting when you and I were talking a couple of weeks ago about what you did prior to this, which was Vertigo.
Yeah, not trucking.
Totally not trucking.
Totally not trucking.
So Vertigo was a company much like Spotify. Is that fair?
No, it was a
music streaming,
but we actually, it was an kind of like it, the closest thing I would say is like, you remember Periscope, people like do live streams, but it was about getting people to listen together. So co-listening and what people now call watch parties. Mm-hmm. We actually coined the phrase listening party, and then that got reused by other people when COVID hit and it became watch parties, and you know, Netflix and other people just started using the name for a specific feature.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was we were trying to build a, you know, social network around, you know, getting people to, you know,
music.
Listen to music together, chat and listen to music together, because one of our observations was that, you know, whenever you're in a big gathering of people, there's always music playing. But all these social experiences we have online, you never have music.
Yeah.
They always feel awkward, like the silence on the Zoom call when no one's talking. You kind of want to fill that in with a playlist or something. So that was the basic, you know, idea behind it. There's a lot of technology behind it, because whenever you're dealing with music, you need lawyers. Like, labels will sue you if you do not use their music correctly. So I had a unique experience as a CTO, because I had to understand the EULAs of all the service providers we worked with. So Spotify's EULA, I actually had to read the whole thing. And Apple Music, had to read the whole EULA and how it works. What terms, you know, how do we not get cut off? Because the way our system worked was we'd actually have people sign in with Spotify. We'd match that music to what someone, let's say someone joins in and they have Apple Music. It's all the same music, basically, right?
Right.
So what we'd do is we'd match, create a system that mapped all the music across different providers. We really only got to Apple and Spotify. It was supposed to. It was a much more ambitious project that never really, you know, had the time to finish it. We got to Apple and Spotify. And what would happen is when people would come in to listen together, and let's say someone picked a song from Spotify, we would map that to a song to Apple or in Spotify, and they could start listening together. And instead of transmitting that song through, let's say, like WebRTC and the audio, you know, as audio packets, which, by the way, would be a really bad way to do it, because WebRTC has really bad quality for audio. You should not listen to music over real-time protocols. Anyway, plus it violates a few copyright laws. So anyway, you don't want to do that. So because it creates an actual broadcast, right? That's actually what radio stations do. They transmit audio over a large space, and it's a single audio file, right? It's a single stream of music, and that's, you have to pay performance royalties for that. There's, Sound Exchange exists specifically to standardize the royalties for radio stations for playing music and all that kind of stuff. So in our case, in order to avoid that, we required that, everyone who came in, if they wanted to listen to music, they had to bring in their own Spotify, their own streaming provider.
So they're already paying for it.
Mm-hmm. They're already paying for it. And whenever they would listen together, instead of combining the audio and video together, those two files were never combined and you could never reproduce them. So there's another type of copyright right called a sync license. Mm-hmm. In that case, if you ever have like video and audio playing in sync together in a reproducible format, you have to pay a different set of royalties. So we avoided those two paying out those two royalties. And funny thing is, on the sync royalties, we had an attorney tell us that we were 50-50. Like there was a 50-50 chance that we could either lose or win a lawsuit if we took it to court. And we're like, okay, that's good enough. 50-50 is good enough. We're gonna take it.
Roll the dice,
and we went with it. It was.
So that was a startup, but that lasted a long time.
Yeah,
was it
10 years?
10 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were CTO for 8 years.
Yeah, I the technology behind it is actually still being used by a company called Remedy. But it's mostly being used for like sharing when the label shares a song on their website or on a social media post. They now use the mapping techniques to, let's say they share a music video, right? Mm-hmm. And they want to have the user actually hear that song from Spotify because they get paid more if you hear it from Spotify instead of YouTube. Mm-hmm. So they have a video synchronizing algorithm that I developed that allows them to synchronize the audio stream with the video without requiring that they're playing together. It's actually based on WebRTC's audio synchronization algorithm. You may not know this, but your audio packets from WebRTC come in as a separate stream from your videos. And the way they synchronize them is a dynamic playback, right? You watched your video all of a sudden speed up on Zoom. It's because when you hear audio speed up, you hear significant distortion. It's like your audio gets a little, like, super squeaky when it plays fast, or you sound like you're the Hulk, like, when it's slower.
Yeah, right.
So with video, you can speed it up, slow it down, and people usually don't notice that much. So what they do is they'll slow down the playback a little bit in tiny fractions to match where the audio packets are. So,
interesting. Yeah. And from a tech perspective, that you not only were there 8 years, but this got pretty big. You have, how many developers did you have?
About 30 developers at one time.
30 developers? Yeah. Was that wasn't here, right?
Oh, it was about 10 developers in Kansas City. 20
oh, okay. So it was
Russia.
Okay.
Yeah, it was half here, like 30% here, 60% overseas.
Okay.
So we did a hybrid thing.
What was the tech stack? What kind of technology were you using?
Java on the back. Okay, so our back end was a microservice architecture. Looking back at it, I'd probably still do it as a microservice architecture again, because the unique thing with social media apps is specifically in live events, you have tentpole moments, and there's only one specific part or two specific parts of the services that need to scale mm-hmm. significantly versus, for instance, your authentication doesn't need to scale with, let's say, your commenting service. Mm-hmm. So in the way we were building, I think a microservice architecture made sense. But it definitely made things complicated to maintain. And we had, we had Java in some places. We had Node in other places. We even had Haskell in some places. And the reason we chose Haskell was because we chose Haskell before AWS actually provided you could get by an instance, but you couldn't, they didn't really have Kubernetes back then. Like the Kubernetes is a service which is like Lambda, Google Cloud Run or Google Apps, like mm-hmm. that type of infrastructure didn't exist. So in order to create a scalable social media experience that could handle significant influencers, that we had several artists that were trying to use our app, We kind of needed to squeeze out every bit of efficiency from our computers and our computational power as possible.
Right.
So we went for something functional that eventually, once, you know, all this, you know, stuff got released, like, and, you know, you had your Lambda, and it became kind of a pain to maintain. You didn't need that. You could have written it in Node, but if only I knew the future.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of one of those unique experiences that, like, you never really understand why someone made a decision unless you were with them in that point in time.
Right. Because
you can look from into the past and think that the solutions you have today were available yesterday, when oftentimes they weren't.
Yeah.
And you're stuck with a different solution, and people look at you like, hey, why'd you do this?
Right.
Well, let me tell you a story.
And then once you're 5 years down the path, it's hard to pivot, I'm guessing.
Oh, right? Yeah, of course. So, it's not easy to pivot.
Right.
So it's harder to pivot once you already have invested into a specific type of architecture, changing it or rewriting it. Rewrites are probably one of the most dangerous things that a company can do, because they add zero value to the user and lots of money. And unless you have lots of money, what's most likely going to happen is you're going to rewrite. You're going to have maybe the same exact problems and the same user experience. Maybe once you're done with the rewrite, your user experience is likely going to drop for the first month or two while you're correcting all those bugs you forgot about while you're rewriting. And then you're going to realize, hey, this rewrite was maybe not worth the 5% improvement I got.
And even thinking about not knowing the future, right? If, let's say, you rewrite it to work with Lambda and Lambda fails. Like, they get rid of it in 3 years because it's not really what they're trying to do.
I mean, those are one of the reasons I've kind of made sure to build everything in Docker recently. maybe Docker is going to fail, but it's being supported by a good chunk of people in this open source project. And at least I could take that to, you know, Google, Amazon, wherever. I've been a little more tried to build in a more platform agnostic way. Those are the CTO days of, you know, there's a lot in there. Vertigo was a very interesting experience. There's a lot to learn from just mistakes we made. I mean, I think one of our biggest mistakes from my perspective as CTO is that I didn't have control of the product. And that was really difficult because, you know, you're expected to deliver a product on time, but you can't actually control the scope. Mm-hmm. And that makes it almost impossible to deliver anything on time. Yeah, it was pretty messed up. That look you're giving me, it was definitely worth it.
I'm confused. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so I could not control scope because I founded the company, but I asked someone else to be the CEO. And he was really, really interested in making sure the product was pixel perfect, exactly how he wanted it. And I could be upset at him, but he died in a heart attack. So I can't even, like, he and I kind of made up and talked through our problems before he died, but he suddenly died of a heart attack. So, I mean, the story of Vertigo ends in a pretty dramatic fashion. with someone dying in a heart attack, and it was pretty shocking.
Wow. So he would just change. The scope was constantly changed. It was a moving target. It was.
Yeah.
You'd be developing towards a certain goal, and then
that goal would change. Yeah, when we talked about the MVP, that's when I came up with the idea of, like, how big of a mistake do you want to make? You're like, we're making $10 million mistakes. It's not a good type of, it's not the right way. So that's one of the primary things I kind of learned was make sure you have your scope in control as, you know, CTO, and your tech team is in control of the scope, because if it's not, then there's really no one responsible, because the people who think they're designing everything, they can't build it and they can't tell you when it's going to get delivered, but then the people who are building it can't really control what it is. So there's really nobody responsible who actually can be responsible for the timeline. And that just leaves a company without the ability to deliver, and do one of the most important functions of a tech company, which is iterate quickly. Mm-hmm. Because you can't deliver as you expect, because you can't
Fear always pivoting.
One part of the company can't control the scope. The other part of the company can't predict or understand how to build it. Right. And so you've split it, and now no one actually has the baby.
Right. Was that CEO technical in his own right, or
no,
totally not technical?
Marketing guy. Brilliant marketer. I think I learned a lot from him when it comes to how to market, mm-hmm. understanding marketing in general.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things I think people don't understand about marketing, especially tech people, is how emotional marketing is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about how people feel. Mm-hmm. And helping people, like, it's about how a person feels in a moment. It has, yeah, there are metrics involved.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to involve people's emotions and problems and address those in a way that connects with them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really good at that. I mean, he was really good at understanding how to, you know, build up hype and all of that kind of stuff. You know, amazing business development officer. I think we had Big Machine Records on our board. We had connections to all kinds of labels. We had the founding member of NSYNC as the original manager of NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. It was actually one guy who helped, you know, do our business development outreach to artists. Like, we had a pretty sweet, you know, he was really good at outreach marketing. What happened with him, from my perspective, is in his previous experiences, he had released products that he believed were inferior because he wasn't in control of them. And he believed they hurt his company in the long run. And maybe they did, because as a non-tech guy, it's really difficult, because either you have to trust someone that you know is going to deliver a high-quality product quickly, or you have to be able to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And that trust that he had in someone in a previous company got broken.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't give it to me in this new company,
which is
interesting.
Very tough.
Yeah,
right?
Tough. I mean, the way that people deal with their scars is really interesting. Sometimes it's easy to turn a person into a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Really, he's a human being who had bad experiences that caused him to make bad decisions based on his feelings about a certain decision.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Looking back on that experience, what would you, let's say you're redoing it, right?
Uh-huh.
What maybe would you change in how you have that set up, just learning from not having control? What might you change in how
just
that was?
Changing the way that the product is developed, I think would probably increase our chance of success significantly.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, you know, I think that was one of the primary things. Like, we had 8 years to iterate, and we didn't iterate that quickly. It took us a year or two often to modify and change, go from one iteration to the other.
Mm-hmm.
For a startup, that's a long iterative cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to iterate over a month or two, a max, versus 6 months, a year. That's too long.
Yeah.
So with 8 years, we should have iterated through a lot more variations of what we wanted to do. So yeah, we didn't, and I think that was one of the I can't go back and be like, hey, and identify any other thing that was, because I could say, oh, I wish we addressed this market, but honestly it may have failed just as big as the other
exactly.
one.
You don't
so
know.
You can't really say, hey, I wish we went into this market and did this. Because you aren't, it's the same reason you can't say, you know, this product is going to succeed, because you haven't tested it. It's not, it's just a hypothesis. It's untested.
Right.
But what I do know, what I have tested, is when a product is being developed with no one in control of the scope or the delivery, it's going to really, really hurt. It's going to fail. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't look back and be like, hey, I wish we did this instead of that.
Sure.
What I can say is, there were process problems that, if corrected, would have given us a significantly higher chance of success.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. One last thing I wanted to kind of, a recurring theme that we have in our podcast is kind of a, you know, how did you get here? Kind of a question, which is, you know, how did you get to be a CTO and now a CEO? Did you start off when you were 18 years old, were you going, you know what, I really want to get into IT, I want to be a CTO, I want to manage large organizations, or were you like...
I actually started as an intern at HSBC Risk USA, and I got bored. I spent 3 months there, and I did not want to live in a cubicle anymore. And I realized that the office life was not for me. I also went to a bank, and I realized that 50% of the people working there were really copying and pasting from one Excel spreadsheet to the other.
Yeah.
And when I came in with my macro experience with like VBScript,
right,
I was like, everyone was asking for help. I was like, hey, do this, yeah, make a copy this over here and do this. And I was just sitting there programming, like, I just realized that the world is very inefficient and that programming could help a lot. And I had, you know, an idea. My wife had a problem. She needed to synchronize her music constantly. And you know, that started, the music synchronization was actually how I started Vertigo. We were going to do file matching at first. Mm-hmm. And that morphed into listening together, because matching files morphed into mapping music across providers. Once we've mapped music across providers, you can now do a streaming watch party, and you can add video to it, you can add a chat to it. And all those things kind of began to evolve. So, I mean, how I started was I got bored working at, in an office.
So were you self-taught on the development side?
Taught myself.
Taught yourself how to program?
And yeah. Honestly, I learned. When I became CTO, I only knew how to program in PHP, which is the single language I hate the most. It does not make sense as a language in general. Like most other languages,
he doesn't know variable devs.
Most other languages are built for humans, and it's not like a unique PHP is weird. Like of all the languages I've studied, PHP, I think Perl's like PHP, maybe a little bit, but the way its syntax is just, it's not the same. It's different. It's weird. And that's what I started programming with. So when I went into JavaScript, I'm like, oh, wait, this is easier to understand. And then
so now
Java,
everything's easier. Yeah.
I mean, so I've done work in C, Java, Haskell, C++, Swift, Kotlin. What else have I touched? I've done C#,
mm-hmm,
Node, and then, you know, all the stuff that comes with Node, you know, sure, React, whatever.
Yeah.
Touched a lot.
Yeah.
And so most of this was stuff I picked up as CTO, because all the people around me were much smarter than me. I the one thing I think I did well was hire people far more intelligent than I am. And I learned from
them. And then learn from them. Right.
Learn from them.
Right.
So I came in with PHP. That's all I had. I ended my company, the one Vertigo ended, I knew how to program in Java, C++, C, Haskell. We did Scala. I knew, you know, how to do big data, you know, stuff with Spark. I done, you know, microservice architectures, all of that.
Yeah.
All I learned doing, everything I learned doing in this, did it all.
But learned it all on the fly.
And I started with PHP.
All self-taught, all on the fly.
Yeah. A lot of times you just got to go for it. I mean, mm-hmm. You're not going to learn everything anyway.
It kind of feels that way, like, you know, in IT. Maybe getting a boot camp or a degree, maybe, go to college, learn your first language. Mm-hmm. But then after that, once you get into it,
we all come in with a significant amount of ignorance. The difference between a guy who has a CS degree and a guy who's self-taught is like maybe 10%. Like the CS guy doesn't have that much more knowledge, because the way the real world works with programming is nothing.
Not like what they teach in the university?
He got syntax, maybe some theory. He learned how a compiler works. He learned how memory works. But ultimately, he doesn't even need to know how the compiler or the memory work. All that information was useless. It was put in to create a curriculum. But the stuff he needed to know, he maybe learned 10-20% of what he really needed to.
Sure. And
that knowledge is pretty, you know.
Really what you need is a basis, because technology is changing so fast that, you know, what you learn today is going to be obsolete in 10 years. And, you know, you've got to be constantly evolving.
You constantly have to. I think that for me, that was when I hired developers. That was the thing I valued the most, is if I saw a person who was willing to learn and willing to try new things, that person was far more valuable in my company than anyone else, because I had learned from experience that this goes back to my thoughts on rewrites. Rewriting almost any part of your stack will usually take 6 months. Learning a new language, having a base of a different language, takes 3 months. All you need is someone who's willing to take the jump, and it costs much less. Because we had parts in our tech stack that were unique languages that people could be like, hey, we could either rewrite this or someone can learn it. And I couldn't get someone to learn it, so we had to rewrite it. And I was like, I couldn't find a person I learned it myself. I taught myself Haskell so I could maintain it, but I couldn't find anyone else who would be willing to learn Haskell, so we had to rewrite it in Node.
I think there's quite a few developers that get kind of locked into a certain tech stack and they want to stay there, right?
It's comfortable.
It's a comfort, right. It's a comfort thing, and they don't have to stretch their limitations.
I think what I realize is people value comfort a lot more. The comfort doesn't produce much. It doesn't make you wealthier. It doesn't help your income increase. It may seem like the end goal in life, but ultimately you get bored. No. You stay too comfortable, you're going to be bored. Yeah. It leads to boredom. So I've always found that living in that little comfortable space I've started two tech startups.
I was gonna say, that's why you keep going into startups.
I just don't like, boredom was the primary reason I couldn't handle going to HSBC Risk for another day and staring at a cubicle and working with Lotus Notes.
Oh, no.
And this was 2005, and I was still working with Lotus Notes.
Right, yeah.
That should tell you how advanced things were.
Exactly.